The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
This is RTE One, where it's time for the 9 o'clock news with Brian Dobson.
Good evening. For the first time in the history of the state, a President of Ireland is to meet a reigning British monarch.
There has been some damage. Does that come from perhaps the way it was handled, that initially you confirmed some of the details and then you said it was none of anybody's business, what money you got, and now you're giving this interview?
The point is, I think if I was legally advised, what I would have said the first morning, the whole lot is nobody any's business.
I'm going to stop that there because the idiots behind you are a bit of a distraction.
Hijacked aircraft crash into the World Trade Center in New York.
Mr. President, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us on the program.
Really, in three ways. I try to help philanthropies in America and around the world.
Well, I mean, I've modelled myself on Ron Burgundy.
Taoiseach, thanks for talking to us on the programme. You told your parliamentary party this afternoon that you're not going anywhere.
I think it's important to point out, first of all, that the government has to focus on recovery.
Perhaps I'll share with you one message that I had from Charlie when I announced my retirement from RTE earlier this year. And his message was, please enjoy the next phase of your career. I would just love to hug you. From all of us on the News of One, very good afternoon to you. Dobbo has left the building.
Well, he may have found what he's looking for in retirement. I just don't know. Brian Dobson, good morning.
And a very good morning to you,
now,
Pat.
The thing is, we've summarised your career in a minute and 30 seconds.
That's fine. That about sums it up.
This is kind of the morning after the night before, because it was all the palaver on Friday. You were doing an interview with the Taoiseach, and then he ambushed you with compliments. I could almost sense your blushes as he passed on those compliments. And then there was the Late Late Show, which was a more formal kind of broadcasting for, well, then it's over. This is Monday. Well, it's Tuesday morning because of the bank holiday. How do you feel?
Well, this is really the first day of retirement, because I suppose a bank holiday, I would have been off anyhow.
Yeah.
So it really was this morning when I woke up and I realised I'm not going to work for the first time in 40 years. I don't have to turn up anywhere suited and booted.
Yeah. Well, what would your regime have been when you're doing the news at one? What time would you surface? When would you start listening to the first bulletins? When would you go online?
Well, I tend to surface quite early, and I think that might continue even though I don't have to be anywhere. And that's a legacy of Morning Ireland. I did 3 years on Morning Ireland after I left the TV, and I've never recovered my sleep pattern. I've remained an early riser, and I never was an early riser before that. So I tend to wake up around, this morning I think I woke up at 5:30 or 6, and I was up, I was listening to the early show here on News Talk from 6, and then that would be my pattern when I was working on the News at One. I'd be starting to think about the day. We had a WhatsApp group, so we'd start exchanging ideas, because the team in News at One would be in the office from maybe 7 o'clock.
Now, I've been asked the same question and I have no answer, but you were asked which do you prefer, radio or television, and you have a very wise answer, which is?
Well, that it's like choosing between your children.
There's
just not possible. They're very different, as you know. I think radio has an immediacy and an intimacy to it.
There's less palaver with makeup and hair and lights and cameras. And when you're interviewing someone, you can be a lot closer to them.
And I think people are more likely to forget they're being interviewed when they're on radio, because there isn't all that technology around them in a studio. But I think it's more than that, Pat. I think there's an intimacy about radio because of the nature of the medium. It's the human voice. The voice is in your head. It's inside you. And I think as well, you engage with radio as one person, one individual. Television is still, I think, more of a sense of a collective audience.
Yeah. Also, I suppose people are very impatient on television. Something's a bit tedious on television, they'll zap and they'll be gone. Whereas you can still, bake that banana bread while you're listening to the radio.
You can multitask.
The change from television when you were doing, say, the 6-1, which everything changed because the 6-1 became the show where the politicians actually wanted to be interviewed. And I sense that was because they all wanted to get home a bit earlier rather than hang around for the 9. And when I was doing prime time on the front line, sometimes hard to get the politicians to stay awake until when you were going on air. So that genesis of the 6-1 programme into a more American-style vehicle...
Yes.
Was that your doing?
Yeah. No, that was established by the time I came on board. And it had been established by Sean Dignan and by Eileen Dunn, who were the original presenters of the 6-1, and Doyle. So it was a well-established programme by the time I took on, I think, around 1996 or thereabouts. I'd been working on the Nine. But I suppose we developed that further. We did, in the years that I was there, perhaps more outside broadcasts. So we'd take the programme to the stories, if they were mm-hmm. big stories, and that could be at home or abroad. I reported from South Africa for the elections there in 1994, anchoring the programme from the roof of the South African Broadcasting House. I broadcast frequently from Stormont and Belfast when the negotiations were underway for Good Friday, and was there on Good Friday 1998.
Now, back in the day, Artie had news readers, not mm-hmm. newscasters. And then it changed where the newscaster, and you were the epitome of that, the acme, if I may say so, of that, you got to interview the politicians instead of leaving it to somebody else to do that. And you just, back in the day, they would read the stories prepared by other people.
Yeah, that was the big change in news presentation. And again, that was something that had been established by the time I came along. And I think it took a little bit of while for the audience, I think, to adjust to that, because I think people felt if you're a newsreader, you should be utterly detached from the story, simply a cipher, if you like, for the information that you're conveying.
And famously, Charles Mitchell, the original newscaster, was an actor.
He was, yes, he was.
And he really told the stories well.
He did, yeah. So that had shifted, and other people had come. Well, even then, people came from a journalistic background into that particular role and began to bring some of those journalistic skills to it. But I suppose we got much more free rein when the 6-1 arrived and when that new approach came along. And I mean, I relished that. I wouldn't have been interested in being a newsreader in the traditional sense. I took on the job because it gave me that challenge.
You mentioned all those outside broadcasts, and the thing that changed really was the technology. The fact that satellites were no longer horrendously expensive to rent time on, so you could broadcast from Stormont or from South Africa and it wouldn't break the bank.
No, and the key, South Africa's an interesting one, because the key to that was that the European Broadcasting Union, of which RT is a member, set up a satellite infrastructure in Johannesburg for those elections, because for RT or smaller broadcasters across Europe to afford their own satellite facilities, it simply wouldn't be affordable. So the EBU set up a shared facility, so we all had and developed actually the technology to be able to switch quickly between Denmark and Ireland and Belgium and the Netherlands and wherever else was on the list.
I remember years ago when I left Current Affairs the first time, before I came back to it many years later. One of the reasons was I was finishing Today Tonight, which was the precursor of Primetime, and we had just broadcast a film made in Libya. I think Una Claffy interviewed Gaddafi.
Yes. Yeah.
And the team had gone out, and 3 weeks later, they finally got the interview with Gaddafi, and they came back, and it was processed and edited, and we got it out. And that night in hospitality, we were all congratulating ourselves on a great scoop. And the news at 10 on ITV came on, and Sandy Gall, the newscaster, was broadcasting from the back of a donkey in Afghanistan by satellite. And I thought, we can't do that. And we couldn't at the time.
But we can now. In fact, you don't even need a satellite. You have a mobile phone. If you have an internet connection, you're on the air. So that really has transformed and taken another huge leap, even in that short number of years.
Mm. Now, when you were interviewing the great and the good and some of the less great and less good, you interviewed over the course all the ministers and all the Taoiseach. How would you characterise those Taoiseach that you did interview? Because each of them was very different in their own way.
They were, as we all are, very different in our ways, but it's the same job, but they had all a very different approach to the job, and I think a very different approach to the media. I started, my first Taoiseach would have been Albert Reynolds. Now, you probably could go back a little bit earlier than that, but Albert was my first, and Albert was definitely somebody who shot from the hip, and he was very accessible to the media. And that worked both ways, because on at least one occasion, Albert phoned me to complain about a story that I had done as business correspondent, and he was Minister for Finance, and I got this call, and we cleared up any misunderstanding. And then John Bruton, the late John Bruton, was a big political thinker. He was a policy man, and I think
a 3-minute interview would not suit his style.
I think he struggled with that sort of very restricted format in his time as Taoiseach. And who followed him? Well, we had Bertie, the great communicator.
He appears in this station regularly, and he had a podcast about the Good Friday Agreement, which we organised. But he could speak for quite a long time without actually saying very much. It was a great
skill. Sometimes part of the art, isn't it? But in there, there'd be the nugget. And he'd know what he wants to say. And I suppose we all like to have somebody for 5 or 10 or 15 minutes, wherever it is. But somebody as experienced and capable as Bertie, and they all understood this, you go in with a certain agenda to address it and a certain number of things you want to say, and no further do you go. And then Brian Cowan, I always thought, felt that interviews were more of an obligation than an opportunity.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes he didn't appreciate the opportunity that appearing on the radio, the television, or it might be, gives a political figure to reach their electorate.
I remember when he was Minister for Finance, and I was on RT Radio 1, and we had him in the morning after the budget. And I remember he kind of, in a cheerful way, he grumbled at me. He says, "I don't know what I'm doing here at all. There's nothing to complain about in this budget," because it was one of the great giveaway budgets.
He was in opposition.
No, he was the Minister of Finance, and he said there was nothing to complain about because it was one of those giveaway budgets. But what you're saying is that he should have perhaps embraced the occasion.
Well, if I was offering him advice, I'm sure he wouldn't take my advice. But I think maybe that's the way I would think of him. And who followed it? Well, Enda came after. Enda was probably the teacher that I interviewed least. I don't know whether it was himself or his handlers kept him really away from the cameras and the microphones. I would say that would be a mistake. Well, obviously, I would, because we want to have access to these people. But I think you need in that business to be match fit. I think you need to be out doing it fairly regularly to keep up that sort of skill level.
The thing about Enda is that if you met him, as I have done over a Christmas drink in O'Donoghue's, he's with his cohorts and I'm with our gang, and he's a gas character.
He's full of crack.
And sometimes that didn't translate.
No, and I think he did a great service to the nation in the way he approached that post-crash period as Taoiseach. You remember him arriving each day. He'd walk up Merrion Street there into government buildings.
There was no murk.
And he was a man going to work. He was going to sit down at his desk, and he was going to set about the nation's business. And I think that helped in its own way to lift our morale. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Moving on to Leo.
Leo. Well, Leo was always great value because he'll go anywhere, he'll answer any question, he must be a nightmare for his handlers, and he always has a news line for you, as you know.
Yeah.
When Leo comes in, you know you're going to have...
We used to call him the man who could not lie.
Well, I wouldn't suggest that any of them lie.
But you'd ask a question and you would get an answer.
You'd get an answer. I think it might have been the last interview I did with them on the News at One, and I wrapped it up with wondering would he be going to see the Wolf Tones whenever it's Electric Picnic, I think they're due to headline or something. And he sort of looked at me and said, "No." And he said, "Why do you ask?" And I said, "Well, I'm just wondering what you make of their resurgence, their popularity." And he began to talk about the island and unification. He said that he would expect unification within his lifetime. I think he'd said it before, but it got a lot of publicity and coverage at the time. And talked about, but more what was missed by a lot of the commentary on it was that he went on to say there's a million people in the north of Ireland who identify as British. And if we're going to have a united Ireland, we have to accommodate that identity. So he's somebody who's thought a lot about what our political future will be.
And what about the latest incumbent then, Simon Harris?
Well, you're missing out Micheál Martin, of course.
Micheál Martin, of course, yes.
And Micheál loved a good scrap, I think. I think he enjoyed a really vigorous exchange.
He is very confident in his own intellectual capacity, Micheál Martin. Like he will brief himself very well.
Yeah.
And it's hard to catch him out.
No, and it's hard to catch any of them out. But he particularly likes, I think, being challenged in an interview. And to the extent that on one recent occasion he was on, he came up and came out of our studio after a reasonably lively back and forth, and said to the editor of the programme, "Thanks very much. I really enjoyed that." And off he went. And the most recent incumbent, I just about managed on Friday on my last day to interview him as Taoiseach.
And he was very complimentary to you.
He was very kind. Yeah,
but yeah. I mean, so I think the problem of him just about being born when you started broadcasting was one of the things that was adverted to. What about leaders of the opposition over the years? I mean, some of them became obviously the leaders of government, but Mary Lou, I suppose, and Gerry Adams would be the two.
Yeah.
Did you have many encounters?
Oh, I did. I interviewed Gerry Adams through election campaigns and on other occasions, and I've interviewed Mary Lou McDonald on quite a number of occasions. It's a tough enough job to be leader of the opposition, I think, and particularly in the situation that Sinn Féin are in now, where they're potentially within the strike striking distance of government. We'll see. We'll have an election and that'll decide that. But certainly the potential is there for a Sinn Féin-led government. And so they need to be careful they don't give hostages to fortune. And again, Mary Lou McDonald is well prepared. She comes in, she knows what she wants to say. She's highly articulate, and she has a technique of keeping talk, almost beginning the next sentence before the last one has ended. So it can be very difficult just to sort of jump in with another question.
Your broadcasting career goes back to the pirate days, and can you remember like any of the things that you did on Radio Nova? I mean, were you doing kind of their news, or yes, were you saying, and yeah, now the latest from?
No. I never spun.
You were
the
never
discs.
DJ, no,
no, no, no.
I was, and
you
for
were,
my sins, yeah, and I enjoyed it enormously.
Track,
the Outside Track was my my show. Yeah. So you were doing, even then, you were doing news.
I was doing news, yeah. Mm. Between you and me, we used to source the news from RTE and rewrite it, and a few other sources as well. Yeah. And we did a bit. We did actually in the later stages. I worked for a station called Radio Nova, and we did some of our own current affairs programs. We had a show called Dublin Today. It used to be a half hour current affairs program, and we did reports and we did interviews. So we were beginning to sort of do our own news gathering and journalism.
And were you always living in fear that the Department of Posts and Telegraphs would burst down the door and shut you down?
Well, not after the one occasion that they did. they raided the station in, it must have been, was it in the pirate station general, I think, 1983. And there was such a public outcry that Radio Nova and the other Sunshine Radio, yeah, went back on the air a number of days later, and the government just let us be.
For very much younger listeners, they won't realise what a wasteland the broadcast spectrum was for people who like pop music. I mean, RTE, Radio 1 would have sponsored programmes on at lunchtime, and maybe at 11 o'clock at night, I did a program called Night Bus. Larry Gogan did a program there as well. But if you wanted popular music, you had to go elsewhere.
Yeah. And RT thought it had addressed that with when it opened Radio 2 or 2FM, whatever it was called at the time. And they didn't. That didn't satisfy the appetite there, because people like to have a choice. It's very simple. In everything in life, will I buy this car or that car? Will I go to this place for my holidays? Will I go there? And people wanted choice in broadcast. Perfectly reasonable. And that's why the pirates, even after the arrival of Radio 2, they still continued to be very successful, to generate big audiences, to take quite a bit of advertising revenue. So they were eating RTE's lunch. And it's why commercial radio has been such a tremendous success. Yeah. I mean, here, national commercial radio, and local radio. Local radio is one of the great media success stories of the last
years. But it's one of the interesting
years.
Things that it forced the government's hand to actually legalise local radio, because it was there, and you can't kind of fight the crowd inevitably and keep shutting down stations and so on. Looking back on the scoops, Brian, and the moments, I mean, you were there when Mandela was elected, so that must have been a high point. But there are many others, I'm sure.
Oh, well, I mean, South Africa definitely is. Good Friday 1998 definitely is one of the highlights. The Queen's visit here in 2011, was it 2012? Definitely a highlight. And, you know, I've interviewed, you heard a clip of me talking to Bill Clinton after he had been president, although he still addressed as Mr. President. That's
of course,
the
Americans keep their titles.
Yeah. So I interviewed him twice. I interviewed Hillary Clinton as well. Interviewed the former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. So I suppose I've had a few notable people sitting opposite me. But actually, what I'd like to think I would be remembered for is being there each night on the television or on the radio in the mornings, whatever shows they were on, broadcasting to an Irish audience, talking to Irish people about things that are happening here in Ireland.
Yeah, and sometimes on a slow news day, you're trying to turn a sow's ear into a silk purse.
Well, it requires a bit of effort, all right. I mean, I'm thinking of my colleagues who are all in work now, beavering away on the news at one. And the news isn't just there, doesn't just fall into your lap, as you know, as your team knows. You have to go out and hunt the material down. You have to persuade people to come on the show to give an interview. You have to try get a sense of what they're going to say, the line of questioning that is going to move the story along. So it requires people, it requires investment, and you know, it requires skill and experience to be able to do all that. And I've been lucky; I've had people with all of that and more.
Yeah, and you were very complimentary on the Late Late Show to all the teams that you have worked with. Question from one of the listeners. Could you ask Brian his opinion? Who was the best leader we never had, i.e. whom we might have had in charge and never made it?
Oh, dear. Who?
That's
who?
A tough one, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
As most of them
yeah.
who were in opposition got there in
yeah.
the end.
Well, Peter Sutherland, who was a former Attorney General in the very early Fine Gael, 1970s Fine Gael government, and was often talked about as a future leader of Fine Gael, but then went off. He was EU Commissioner, and he was chair of the World Trade Talks, and he had a splendid international career. I suppose someone like that, you'd be intrigued to think, what if somebody like that had stayed in politics locally, what impact they might have had.
Because he became a global figure.
Yeah.
And again, his intellect was absolutely profound. You married into a broadcasting dynasty, didn't you?
that's
putting it slightly over the top.
My wife is a niece of Larry Gogan. So Kriya is Kriya Gogan. So her dad and Larry were brothers. But we didn't meet through. We met entirely separate to any RT connection whatsoever.
But you eventually did meet Larry, of course, the legend.
Oh, I did. But only really when I got to know Kriya. Yeah, and he was a wonderful man. He was somebody who was to me a hero because he was somebody, and I've said this very often, he loved his job. He was very, very good at his job. He was engaged right up to the end by the new music, by the bands. And he never went around saying that he should have had this or he should have had that or his talents were overlooked. He just loved doing what he was doing.
Yeah, and I travelled with him quite a few times when I was doing television commentary on the Eurovision Song Contest, which is happening this week, and Larry was doing radio. And many's the great night we had in these far-flung cities. Brian, what next? What next? Nothing?
For the next while, not a whole lot. No, not a whole lot. I have a few things that I'm involved in on the charitable, voluntary side, and I'll obviously be still giving that attention. And I might have a little holiday, to maybe a little bit of travelling. My happy place is sailing a boat, so I'll be sailing a boat with my
Funny
pal.
You should say that. Gordon in Kildare says, I remember when joining sailing in Dublin and seeing Brian was a member, I was totally taken aback. But I never got to crew with them, unfortunately.
Oh,
you think you were dead. There's still time. Gordon, there is still time.
Let me give a shout out. Sailing in Dublin is a great organisation. You can join for 350, 400 euro, whatever. And then you get access to the number of boats, cruising boats, and you can have some experience, no experience, and you'll get a chance to get out on the water. And it makes sailing wonderfully accessible to anybody who has any kind of an interest in it.
Yeah. Do you think that Oliver Callan will leave you alone now? Or will he have you sailing the Med in a rather, large cruiser?
I'd be curious to find out how he replaces me or because he uses me as the voices off, doesn't he? The Greek chorus.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering who'll qualify for that role in the future.
Well, Brian, look, thank you very much for coming in and doing your last bit of on-air stuff for a while. I know that if somebody calls you, you'll listen, but you won't necessarily do anything yet.
No, I think I'll just pause for a little while.
Pause for thought. Anyway, Brian Dobson, legendary RTE newscaster and so much more. Dobbo is still in our building, but he's leaving shortly. Brian, thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.